At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They've found radiation in tap water, raw milk, and 11 kinds of vegetables now in Japan. There's rationing in Tokyo, an unfinished struggle still inside those nuclear plants. Almost 10,000 dead, 16,000 more missing, and all that desperate earthquake and tsunami wreckage, mile after mile. Will this time of catastrophe change Japan? How? This hour on Point, Japan after the quake. You can join the conversation. Does this catastrophe, this triple blow of quake and tsunami and near meltdown, change Japan? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We have all been watching and listening day by breathless day as Japan has struggled to deal with that blow after blow after blow. In Tokyo today, Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Yukio Adano, announced that three workers were exposed to high levels of radiation while doing maintenance work inside that big Fukushima Daiichi plant. Two were hospitalized. Here's Secretary Adano speaking through an interpreter.
Yesterday, at reactor building number 3, workers were laying cables. Some stepped into water, and the water apparently contained higher levels of radiation.
We have heard from people in this crisis that are seldom heard from in this way publicly in Japan, including Japan's emperor, 77-year-old Akihito, first time on television, who spoke, you've all heard it, but here's a little bit more, to his nation.
The accident at nuclear power plant causes deep worry, and I hope the efforts by staff can avert the situation getting worse.
And we have heard speculation about what and why, sometimes kind of out there. Here's Tokyo governor, he's a character himself, Shintaro Ishihara, who blamed, in this little clip, he's apologized since, but blamed aspects of the Japanese people themselves for the recent quake and tsunami disasters.
The Japanese people must take advantage of this tsunami to wash away their selfish greed. I really do think this is divine punishment.
Of course, Americans know that kind of language. I've heard it after disasters here as well, but it's left us thinking about Japan and the Japanese and what may come from this time of trial. We have a couple of great Japan watchers with us today, people who know the country and its culture well and deeply. From New York, Ian Baruma joins us, famed Dutch man of letters, now professor of democracy, human rights, and journalism at Bard College, author of Taming the Gods, Religion and Democracy on Three Continents. His essay on post-quake Japan, titled Japan's Shattered Mirror, appeared in Saturday's Wall Street Journal. Ian Baruma, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And with me in the studio is Richard Samuels, professor of political science and director of the Center for International Studies at MIT, founding director of their Japan program, longtime celebrated Japan scholar, and an old friend, author most recently of Securing Japan, Tokyo's Grand Strategy, and the Future of East Asia. Dick Samuels, thank you very much for being here today.
It's good to see you again, Tom.
Ian Baruma, first to you, if I may. I mean, we've all been reminded of just how long and how deeply Japan has been imprinted by disasters, certainly of the earthquake and tsunami kind before, in Japan's case, the nuclear kind before, even far worse at the end of World War II. How do you see this in the scale of challenges that Japan has faced over the time the rest of the world's been thinking about it? Does this rank? Is this right up there? Is this like the black ships that led them to change, or the end of World War II, or something less?
Well, I think it has to be something a little bit less than that. In 1945, the whole country was devastated. In this case, terrible though it is, it's in a fairly remote part of Japan. It's not the same as in 1923, even when much of Tokyo was leveled.
The Great Kanto Quake.
The Great Kanto Quake. So I think it's devastating, it's horrible, but I don't think it's going to turn the country upside down.
Will it turn it at all? Will it turn it somehow? I mean, Japan has been struggling for a couple of decades now since its economy peaked and was so absolutely lush in the 1980s. It's been a long slog since then. What does it mean for the country psychologically at the end of such a long slog now to get this triple blow, Ian?
Well, recently in that long slog, there were already significant changes when, for the first time since the war, almost for the first time, a new government took power that wasn't dominated by one big conservative party. That was already quite a change, and people were very hopeful and since then have become more cynical and disappointed and so on. But one thing to look at is to see how this new government is going to come out of this. The other thing is the role played by the so-called self-defense forces, which was a rather sort of hidden force that made people feel slightly embarrassed. Japan didn't really want to even have an army after the war. It was entirely dependent on the United States for its security. Now the self-defense force soldiers have come out in force, and I think it's bolstered their image considerably, and that may change the debate on the way the Japanese see themselves, the way the Japanese are seen from the outside world. It may have a positive effect. So I don't think all the potentials are negative.
Dick Samuels, we've seen the losses here. I mean, they stretch on and on. The TV cameras pan over them again and again. And there may be some we don't see yet. The radiation that is now frightening people even in Tokyo, reaching well beyond the area of the quake itself. So we've seen the losses. What about potential winners coming out or aspects of Japan, Japanese culture, Japanese politics that may actually be encouraged by what's happened here?
Well, it's kind of awkward to talk about winners at a time like this. But for some
trends may be advantaged, though, or it's just the way life works.
It is the way life works. And for some, there'll be silver linings in these very, very dark clouds. And two of them are the ones that Ian's already mentioned. It seems to me, in the short term anyway, the government in Japan, which was elected in 2009, as he said, with an overwhelming majority, the largest in the history of Japanese democracy.
Historic repudiation of the Liberal Democratic Party, which had ruled since essentially the war, World War II.
Precisely, and which had very close relationships with the electric utilities and large industry, which is now coming in for deserved criticism. This government has already benefited from a rally around the flag effect. It had trouble even passing a budget in the days before the quake. Now it has new taxing powers and is being seen by and large as responsive, at least as compared to the way that the LDP government responded in 1995 when it failed to mobilize relief efforts in a timely way. And that links directly to the other group that Ian identified, which is the Japanese military. The self-defense forces, as they're called there, hadn't been seen as legitimate by a large number of Japanese until very recently, and to many still aren't or hadn't been. But now the government has mobilized over 100,000 troops. It's the largest mobilization of Japanese armed forces since the Pacific War. And there's a widespread appreciation for their fortitude. They've rescued over 19,000 people, and they seem well-positioned to go forward as a legitimate part of the Japanese national system.
Part of the reason for the low profile of the Japanese military after the war was the pacifist constitution that Americans essentially wrote for Japan after Japan's defeat in that war. This new government, the Democratic Party of Japan, DPJ Party, that came into power, as you say, began its time in power looking to push back against its American influence in Japan life, particularly against the American presence on Okinawa, where we have such a big military base. What about the Japan-U.S. relationship after this disaster?
That may be the biggest winner of all. As they come out of this, as you say, during the Hatoyama months, that is the first DPJ government from the summer, early fall of 2009 until 2010, it was a very rough patch. The Japanese were trying to find just the right distance between their longtime American ally and the rising China on their border. There were a number of issues that were burrs under the alliance saddle, the Okinawa base issue, the relocation of a marine air base in Futenma and so forth. They threatened cuts in host nation support. They ended assistance to U.S. and British troops that are fighting in the Afghan war and so forth. Now, this was patched up by the current prime minister. But now there's been an outpouring of U.S. support. There are over 50 U.S. nuclear power experts have been dispatched to help with that part of the crisis and something called Operation Tomodachi, Friendship.
Friendship.
Which is has been created, the largest joint operations in the history of the alliance. At the request of the Japanese government, a joint task force.
These are the naval formed. Ships, U.S. naval ships off the shore of Japan, or is it onshore as well?
It's onshore as well, including for emphasis, some of the helicopters from the Marine Air Base in Futenma. But they have been transporting Japanese troops. They've been transporting Japanese equipment and supplies to the affected area. They've been operating not just out of U.S. military bases across the island and offshore. The USS Ronald Reagan and the Carrier Strike Group was redeployed. But they also have been operating at commercial airfields for the first time. So in a way, you know, you wonder if this could even stimulate the main islanders, the people not on Okinawa, to reconsider the desirability of having U.S. bases close at hand.
There had been talk of Japan turning toward China, less toward the United States. What about that in this moment?
Well, you know, the Chinese had really overplayed its hand vis-a-vis the Japanese last year.
Japan bashing, you know.
There was an enormous amount of that, not just, I mean, the anti-Japanism in China is a recurring problem for the relationship.
Since Japan's occupation of China in World War II.
That's right. I mean, the history issue for the Sino-Japanese relationship is the sort of the analog of the base issue in the U.S.-Japanese relationship. Mm-hmm. And in a dispute last year when a commercial fishing vessel, it was said, entered Japanese waters and the captain was arrested. The Chinese reacted with more like the dragon and less like the panda. And the result was they cut off rare earths exports to the Japanese. They harassed the Japanese ambassador and so forth.
But now they've sent aid to Japan. We'll come back and look at that. Dick Samuels, please stand by. We have to take a short break here. Ian Baruma in New York. It's so good to have both of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, the sound there of radiation monitoring in Japan in the aftermath of the earthquake and the tsunami and the near meltdown that the whole country there has been struggling with in these recent weeks. We're talking today about Japan after the quake, its culture, its politics, its outlook with Ian Baruma, author of Taming the Gods, longtime Japan observer with real deep experience of this country and its people, its culture. He joins us today from New York. And with me in the studio, Richard Samuels of MIT, also longtime observer of Japan, author of Securing Japan, who's been paying a lot of attention to what's happened and what may come in the aftermath of the catastrophe there. Here's Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton signing a book of condolences at the Japanese embassy in Washington this week and pledging support to Japan in its time of need.
This has been an unprecedented disaster, but it has provoked an unprecedented show of resilience by the Japanese people and a pledge of cooperation and friendship from the American people.
And here from Okinawa, 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force, U.S. Lieutenant John Norton, 1st Lieutenant, saying that the U.S. troops there were hard at work helping the recovery and aid efforts in Japan.
It's been difficult, but the Marines on the ground are very well trained, and they're aggressively supporting really this alliance between ourselves and the Japanese government and the Japanese people.
We're looking with Ian Baruma and Dick Samuels at how Japan may change, may shift, may turn, may recover. We'll recover from this big hit. Let's get our listeners in here right away, if we may. Call Ocean, calling from Boston. Ocean, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, most Chinese have problem with Japanese. But now, because of this disaster, and I think most Chinese now are more forgiving. Mm-hmm. And I'm a medical scientist, discover new biologic to protect stem cells against radiation damage. And I didn't want to sell my drug to Japanese pharmaceutical because I'm Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because of this disaster, I'm thinking to donate my drug to Japanese. And also, I think money cannot buy health. And this is very important because otherwise the mutation will be very severe. And I also planning to organize symposium about radiation in Boston and in Japan at no charge. So we can gathering a lot of people to understand the damage of radiation.
So it's really bringing out your sympathy for Japan as a Chinese person.
Yes. Not only for Japanese, this will be potentially in the future for the rest of the world, because in case, say, America have dirty bomb, you know, people who going cleaning the dirty bomb, also radiation. So we shall protect these people against radiation damage.
Ocean, there's a turnaround right there in your perspective and your voice. Ian Buruma, what about these two great Asian powers? It was only weeks ago now that China took over from Japan as the number one economy in the world. The tension, the rivalry between them, great, as Dick Samuels began to say, over a whole litany of things, rare earth metals and you name it. How do you see that relationship potentially changing in the aftermath of this disaster, Ian?
Well, I think that has been one of the positive aspects of it all. Not just the Chinese, the Koreans too. Apparently the Korean press has been full of praise of Japanese discipline and resilience.
And this from the former colony of Japan, who you did not often hear that kind of talk from.
Indeed, I think it was probably the first time. And not only that, but the response in Japan has been interesting, because in 1995, when Kobe was hit by a devastating earthquake, the conservative government, then in power, was very reluctant to accept foreign help. They were touchy. There were questions of pride and so on. Not this time. And the fact that Chinese and Koreans, as well as Americans and Europeans and others, are helping, and that help is gratefully accepted, I think shows a new openness to the outside world, as well as willingness from the outside world to come in and help. So I think that can only be a good thing. Now, will that resolve deeper tensions between China and Japan and on a security and economic level and political level? That is something else. I mean, one shouldn't be too Pollyanna-ish about this. But I do think it's a positive development.
Dick Samuels, at the level of sentiment, that is very clearly a warming right there around humanitarian aid in this disaster. At the same time, though, there is a real rivalry here, and China has pulled ahead, and one can't help but wonder, when you see all the damage to Japan's infrastructure coming now, with this, when there's this big head of steam in China, I mean, does this put China even further forward of Japan? Does it change Japan's international standing further?
Well, it could in the short run, but it depends on how Japan reconstructs itself in the longer term. I just want to say that that Ocean's offer was very heartening, and it reflects a larger mood that one detects now in China. The Chinese recalled and reminded themselves and spoke openly among themselves about Japan's generous aid to the Xinjiang victims, the victims of the earthquake.
Yes, their own earthquake.
Mm-hmm. A terrible disaster to which the Japanese responded with great philanthropy and generosity. And that the Chinese leadership recognized that and responded very quickly with aid, not an enormous amount in dollar terms, but an enormous amount in symbolic terms, and also sent a rescue team. More important, it seems to me, is that the netizens in China are saying admiring things of the Japanese.
The netizens, the online community.
The online community, I'm told.
They have no reason to. I mean,
they have always been the sort of the leading bleeding edge of anti-Japanese
Chinese nationalism.
And Chinese nationalism. Mm-hmm. Here they're admiring the Japanese. They're reminding each other of Japanese generosity. And you know, this may be veiled criticism of their own government, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that we are seeing a larger mood and a softer mood. And Ian is right. Whether this changes the military balance in the region or the prospects going forward on a military side is uncertain, but certainly it's welcome.
Is there room for I mean, Japanese firms are already in China. Is there room for more engagement there that this might open up? Never mind rankings, never mind exactly the numbers, but there's been this very touchy relationship. I mean, can you imagine a new sort of Asian geopolitical profile where interests are interests, but Japan and China, Ian, come to see themselves as more akin than at sword tips?
Well, that's already been happening. After all, in some ways, the Japanese economy was bailed out by the China boom, and Japanese are doing enormous amounts of business in China. And at the same time, there are contradictory trends. One trend is in Japan is fear of China, anxiety that they'll be dominated, that the Chinese will throw their weight around more and so on. On the other hand, more young Japanese are learning the Chinese language now than ever before. Well, when I say ever, they always used to learn classical Chinese, but the modern Chinese. Young people are traveling there and so on. So I think there is a move towards engagement with East Asia, of which Japan is, of course, a part, and as well as apprehension.
Let's get a call from Christian in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Christian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to address the topic or the issue of greed that was in the top of your newscast and, you know, kind of put it in terms of turning around from what's going on in Japan. And that's in terms of addressing the real cost of our energy choices. Here in Japan, you know, we're starting to see the real human toll, but we never really see that in the pitch for nuclear power, that it could cost this many lives. The same with coal and oil. Here in Tennessee in 2008, we had the world's largest fossil fuel spill, over a billion gallons of coal waste into the Tennessee River. We had the Gulf oil spill. But you never hear in the pitch for these energy choices these real, true, hidden costs. And it has to do, I think, a lot with our greed. And I think if those costs were factored into those energy choices, solar would look really, really affordable and good.
Christian, let us pick up the Japanese perspective on the other side of this unresolved problem with their big nuclear power. And I appreciate your raising that. Ian Bruma, let me come first to you with that one, because I think on many people's minds, as we've seen Japan struggle with this, and the, you know, the nearly almost suicide mission of people going in, men going into those plants to try and cool the rods and keep things under control, wondering about how Japan is taking that on board, and radiation warnings for infants on tap water in Tokyo, this in the country that, of course, was hit first and devastatingly by nuclear weapons in World War II. What led Japan to turn to so much nuclear energy in the first place? I mean, you're right. Emperor Hirohito said, you know, this nuclear weapons could lead to the total extinction of human civilization. And now we've got 50-plus plants in Japan. Can you see a turnaround on their relationship with nuclear energy after this, Ian?
Well, Japan, of course, is very poor in natural resources. The whole world is talking about getting rid of its dependence on oil and so on. So there must be some future for nuclear energy. And of course, the Japanese have always been sensitive about it. It must be said that the current disaster is not necessarily a total indictment of nuclear energy. These plants are very old. There were maintenance problems, and because of the cozy relationship between the politicians and the bureaucrats in Japan and the corporations, including the corporation TEPCO, that ran these nuclear plants, these things were not taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are rightly in Japan very cynical now about everything said by the company. But it has a lot to do with the system as it grew, the political system as it grew after the war, and this government at least is trying to do something about it. So I don't think it means that Japan has to completely abandon nuclear energy, although, of course, solar energy would be grand. But I think it does mean that there has to be far more oversight and far more transparency.
But Dick Sammons, it must have a terrible and special edge for the Japanese to be dealing with radiation. I mean, after all, for decades now, you know, the whole Hiroshima story has been told again and again in that country. They know it very, very well. the impact of all the aftermath there, and now from their own plants comes this radiation threat.
No, indeed. As we all know, the Japanese understand radiation better than any nation in the world, and yet they allowed their desire to grow and their confidence in technology as a fix for a resource-poor nation to overcome their fears and their anxieties about radiation. Mm-hmm. I agree with Ian. I don't think this is an indictment of nuclear energy per se, but I think it's a strong indictment and will be read as a strong indictment of the regulators and the political leaders who allowed the system to proceed. Who looked the other way in many cases, a remarkable number of cases, at regulatory failures and so forth. You know, this is a moment when they'll be rebuilding on a grand scale. Mm-hmm. And whenever there has been rebuilding on a grand scale after the devastation of the war and at other times, it's always enabled a country, a national economy, to take a jump, a major increase in the technological capabilities. And my guess is that we'll see not the abandonment of nuclear energy, but after a lot of Sturm und Drang, mm-hmm. we're going to see the adoption of new kinds of energy, including nuclear. It'll be in the mix.
What about on that rebuilding front and what Japan was striving for? I mean, we heard that comments, and you write about them as well, Ian Buruma, from Shintaro Ishihara, the infamous governor of Tokyo, calling the earthquake divine punishment for egoism and greed. Is that a new theme out there, that we took consumerism too far? Is that an old theme of the Japanese political perspective that wants a kind of a everybody lined up in self-denial? What do you make of his comments? Is there an audience for that, Ian?
Well, there is an audience for him. It's an old theme, both on the left and the right. I mean, the left, of course, everywhere has always been critical of consumerism and greed and capitalism and so on. On the right, you have this idea represented by Ishihara, who's a maverick. He's a kind of Glenn Beck of Japanese politics. And the idea on the right is that the Japanese have lost their old spirit, their emperor-worshipping marshal spirit and so on, and the right have been harping on that, and that the young Japanese are soft, that they're selfish and so on, and he's used this occasion yet again to voice these views. Now, there is an audience for it. How big it is, I'm not so sure. I think probably the instant protest that it provoked shows that a lot of Japanese are getting rather tired of this kind of language.
But what about the notion of turning away from the consumerism and, you know, relentless economic push of the post-war years? Japan is aging. It doesn't have the labor pool that it once had in any case. Does it get right back up on the, you know, let's go for growth platform? Or, I don't know, does some kind of new Shintoism emerge here that says, wait a minute, could Japan be the first one in the aftermath of this disaster to turn around and say we want something different, Ian?
I don't really know. It certainly wouldn't be Shintoism. In many ways, the Japanese juggernaut had already lost steam long before this earthquake. I mean, people had been sitting back a little. It had become a rather placid country, certainly compared to China. Now, the effort to rebuild may indeed reinvigorate the economy, as it often does in the aftermath of these disasters. Whether it'll mean that the Japanese will turn into a completely different direction or become like the Japanese of the 50s and 60s, I very much doubt that. I mean, it is already a highly developed economy, and so I don't think we'll see radical change either spiritually or economically.
Gung-ho Japan in the rebuilding, Dick Samuels, or something else?
Well, I think it will be a gung-ho Japan for rebuilding. Just a word on Governor Ishihara. He's just announced that he's going to run for a fourth term as governor of Tokyo. And it'll be interesting to see how the voters mm-hmm. respond to him. My guess is that this is a classic moment for the formation of a new generation in Japan, and he is probably the archetype of the old. He epitomizes the old generation in a way that Ian's described. But why a new generation now? Because it's a moment in which large numbers of young Japanese will have a similar shared experience, and it's going to shape a lifelong orientation towards society and politics. It seems to me. The question is, there's going to be a struggle, a political struggle, over how to frame what happened, who gets blamed, and how they talk to themselves about what happens going forward.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Japan after the quake and tsunami and near nuclear meltdown, looking at its culture, its politics, its outlook, with Ian Baruma, author most recently of Taming the Gods, professor at Bard College, longtime observer of Japan. And with me in the studio, Richard Samuels, Dick Samuels, author of Securing Japan, Tokyo's Grand Strategy and the Future of East Asia, professor at MIT. Let's get a call from Dubuque, Iowa. Gary, thanks for calling. You're on the air, Gary.
Thank you. And I just wanted to comment that I don't hear enough talk about the radiation being, while it's dangerous, exposure to high levels of radiation can be controlled. And I'm a former repair worker in nuclear reactors. I was at Tri-Cities, Washington on the Hanford project. And part of my job was going into these hot zones while a reactor was shut down to do repair work. And there are so many safeguards, and the training that I had prior to going in there told me that a lot of radiation just passes through your body, and the only time that you have to worry basically is if you get materials on your skin or on your person. And I mean, I had dosimeters and radiation badges, and when we came out of a zone, there were monitors there with Geiger counters that checked us over. And if you had some dirt on your body, it was washed off in a manner with a topical agent that peeled the skin off in layers until you were no longer dirty.
Gary, I hear it. At the same time, here's Japan, and you've got the direct experience. At the same time, here these guys are going in the dark when it's blazing hot in there. They've got radioactive steam gushing out. I mean, they're in a, talk about repair. You can't get much more dire in terms of the damage to a plant than what they're grappling with. Dick Samuels, I wondered on this front, how you see the Japanese looking at what's happened here and how you see the calamity itself, whether or not it's over. I mean, they've been fighting against a full meltdown. Do you have the sense that they've turned the corner on that or not? Could they still... You know, Gary says, look, if it stays right here, people can deal with it, but could it still go further? Could it still collapse into a bigger problem, Dick?
Well, I'm not a specialist on nuclear engineering and nuclear science. I wouldn't speculate on the prospects for it collapsing. But I think Gary's surely correct on the technical side. But it's a very hard sell to a traumatized nation that is getting conflicting reports about whether or not they can drink the tap water.
All the way in 150 miles away in Tokyo.
150 miles away, where 25% of the population of the country lives. Before coming over to the studio today, I looked at the NHK, which is streaming online and has been providing that service since the earthquake. And there was a...
Japan Broadcasting.
The National Broadcasting Company of Japan. And there was a professor dressed in a cardigan sweater looking for all the world like Mr. Rogers, explaining how the levels of radiation are nothing to be too upset about and so forth. He was trying to
ease people's minds.
And, you know, there's going to be this pull and tug back and forth going forward. That's for sure.
What about the framing you mentioned earlier, Dick, about how what's just happened is going to be, you know, sort of packaged ultimately and thought of? Societies look for ways after disasters to share an understanding. Shintaro Ishihara, the governor of Tokyo, had one notion he put out there early and got whacked a bit for. But how do you see the wrestling over that going forward?
Well, I really do think that how that narrative evolves is going to determine how this next generation responds.
What are the options?
Some will want to blame the Japanese state. So the question then is, which Japanese state do you blame? Do you blame the conservatives who pushed high growth over safety and were cozy with the electric utilities? Or do you blame the current government, which is a center-left government that inherited the system but might be blamed for a slow and sometimes confusing response? Again, We don't know, but we do know that others will want to celebrate Japan's civic virtues, you know, the calm and the organized and the generous nature.
Which have been remarkable.
It has been remarkable. Heroes are going to be identified. You know, one is actually Edano, the chief cabinet secretary.
Mm-hmm. We heard from earlier.
We heard from him earlier, and we were told that children today talk to each other about how tired they are in a new metric called Edanos. I'm three Edanos tired.
What does that mean?
They look at
does he have a sleepy face?
Well, he does. He's exhausted, and he's been on television nonstop, and the kids joke among themselves about how many Edanos tired they are, having done their homework or so forth. It's a way to release some of the anxiety. But heroes are going to be identified. But at the end of the day, I think communitarian values are going to be reinforced. What's going to happen is political entrepreneurs of all stripes are going to be competing to control the narrative, and the winner is going to be able to impose his or her vision going forward. And I think we have yet to see how that'll play out.
Ian Baruma, communitarian values, we've seen them on display, the whole world watching admiringly as Japanese line up and help so orderly and helping each other in so many ways. If communitarian values come back to the fore, does that push old politics back to the fore, or the new politics, which may be more democratic, small d?
I don't think the old politics are going to come back in the way that they existed in the 50s and 60s, because after all, a deal was then made in rebuilding Japan after the war with the growing middle class, which was an exchange that the middle class had to agree to be politically quiet and obedient and so on, live with basically a de facto one-party state, in exchange for which the one-party state would guarantee high-speed growth, doubling everybody's income and roaring ahead. That's not going to come back, because in some ways the nuclear disaster is an echo of the flaws in that way of thinking. So I'm hoping that it will be more democratic. In a way, it's a pity that the current Prime Minister, Kan Naoto, mm-hmm. who's been trying his best, I think, to cope with an impossible situation, but he's not a television performer. He hasn't established a high profile. That's left up to Edano, the cabinet secretary. But I hope that this government will come out of it stronger. But I mean, when I say I hope, I don't voice any great expectation.
Let me get a call here from Omaha, Nebraska. Fred's on the line. Hi, Fred. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you think, Fred?
Well, I'm thinking, now they're blaming the, one put blame on the power companies, or blame on the government for not sustaining this. No one is blaming the earthquake. The earthquake caused this disaster. If it happens someplace else, even here in the United States, we've got a big cauldron here of a molten lava under Yellowstone Park. If that thing goes, a lot of power is going to be lost. The Hoover Dam will probably go, or this dam out near there.
Well, maybe. I mean, I hear you, Fred, but on the other hand, when people build nuclear plants, they're supposed to plan for exactly those natural threats, right? Just because the threat is so severe, but let us pick that up. Dick Samuels, I had a question on Fred's point all the way along here. You watch the television images of smoke pouring out of those big nuclear cooling towers, and there it is in Fukushima, the Daiichi plant. It's right on the beach, in a country, Dick, where tsunamis have been around and been beautifully captured in art, woodblock prints and all the rest, forever. What about the planning here? Were people cutting corners?
No, there's no question that the design flaws of the Japanese nuclear power industry are on full display, and it's not just that they were on the beach, but it's where the auxiliary power systems were located in the equipment. It's that they were built on fault lines, and then when that was discovered, that there was a cover up of that. There's a long history of failed regulation that is going to be in the center of the political bullseye for a long time going forward. we have to remember that the regulatory organization, the agency that's responsible for regulating the nuclear power industry in Japan, sits inside the same ministry that's responsible for promoting nuclear power in Japan, which is the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry. This also is going to get some attention, and properly so.
What are the energy implications then if Japan is going to be turning away or turned by this disaster, turned away from some of its nuclear power? What does that mean for the rest of the world in terms of fossil fuels, demand for oil, where that goes, Dick?
Well, I think there is going to be an increased demand for oil and increased prices, presumably. Also, Japan is the largest importer of liquefied natural gas, an enormous importer of that, and it's already begun. Supplies of that have already begun increasing and diverted from other consumers along the way. So we are going to see an effect on the global energy market. That goes without saying. Can I just say one word about go back to something that Ian was saying, which I thought was just right about Kan Naoto.
The prime minister
not being a TV talent. One thing, though, is also true about it. That is certainly true, but it's also true that when he was the minister of health and welfare a decade or more ago, he was the one who stood up to the regulators for their failures when there was a tainted blood supply,
mm-hmm.
and he became enormously popular in Japan. So he has this history of standing up and getting in the face of cozy business government relations and. I think much of Japan is waiting for him to do it again.
I want to ask you on another front, Dick, if I may. The Prime Minister, all of Japan, the estimate of damage here is $300 and some billion worth of damage, the biggest damage toll ever in terms of that kind of accounting. Japan is very, very famously deeply in debt. Can it borrow the money to rebuild? And if it does, in a period when so many countries are deeply in debt, what does that mean for Japan's own finances, for global finance, Dick, if it goes out into the market for that scale of money?
Well, you know, after the last earthquake, the Kobe earthquake in 1995, Japan actually saw a boom. An economic growth boomlet, I should say, because in the course of the last 20 years, it's been a
overall
difficult time.
Flat, but a boomlet then because on the back of the rebuilding,
and we expect to see Japan repatriating its funds, but we haven't.
That is bringing them home from elsewhere around the world.
Yeah. The obvious target would be U.S. Treasuries, which would have ramifications here. But we haven't seen that, in fact, in the first weeks after this. So I think the jury's out on exactly what the global macroeconomic effects.
But you and Bob Madsen wrote recently that ultimately what we're looking at here could contribute to, you write, a financial debacle comparable in scale to the 97-98 East Asian crisis or the implosion of the technology bubble. How would that flow through?
Well, a reminder that in both of those cases, that debacle that we talked about might have been a little hyperbolic in the shadow. We were writing that
sure
in the shadow
scary.
of the events. But the fact is, if you go back and look at the history, that this was a minor blip in the overall development of the global economy.
In part because the United States stepped in and helped deal with it, but we're not in a position to do that in the same way anymore. Maybe China would be, but how would we get to that? What would be the series of financial steps that would take?
Well,
us
I mean,
to
you know, at the end of the day, the Japanese are going to have to tax themselves more. The Japanese are going to have to deploy their considerable national wealth to make this thing right. And we talk a lot about, and it's well known, that the Japanese national debt is something like 200% of GDP,
mm-hmm.
and where we in the United States are wringing our hands at the 85%
right.
level. They're, in a way, a poster child for fiscal insolvency, and yet they're going to have to do something with it. So the question is, how does that work? Well, most of the Japanese debt is held by Japanese in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And so
unlike ours.
And so they have, it's said, degrees of freedom that we wouldn't enjoy in a similar circumstance.
To reach down in their own pockets, around their own debt, and work on it. Let's get another call. Sam in Somerville, Massachusetts. Sam, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Sam. What do you think?
Well, I studied abroad 2002 to, from 2007 to 2008 in a little town near Kobe, which was the site of the big earthquake in 1995.
Yeah.
It was a place that was really aware of its earthquake history. I had professors who, you know, were woken up and their wives were almost injured and things like that. And in 4 weeks, I'm going to be returning to that university to work in their study abroad office. I just got hired there.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much. But it's obviously kind of a confusing time to be going back there for a profession. So my question for the professors and yourself is, what do you all think the influence of this disaster on Japanese studies is going to be? Because, you know, when I was studying Japanese in college at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, there was a lot more hubbub about Chinese studies and much more of a focus as far as Asian studies is concerned on looking at China as the new country
sure.
to go to. And,
what about now? Our time is short. Let us pick it up, Sam. In Buruma, that brings us back to this Japan-China relationship and, you know, where the mojo is. There may be a big rebuilding boomlet in Japan, but when you look at the sort of relative global profile of these two countries, surely this one raises China even to a greater degree, Ian.
I'm not so sure about that. Mm-hmm. Also, anything that gives a country a profile will probably make people interested. And people have studied Japan for different reasons. There was a generation that studied it for its literature. Then there was a generation that studied it for its business. Then it was anime. Whether people are going to study it because of natural disasters is a question. But I think there are general lessons to be learned from this and from Japan. We keep on talking about Japan as though it's a unique case. But when we talk about regulation, for example, in this country, it's become an article of faith for many people that somehow regulation is socialist and business can take care of itself and so on. Mm. One lesson to be drawn from what's happened there, that's patently not the case. So Japan is worth studying for our own sake as well as knowing more about another country.
You remind us that Japan has a long history of rebuilding. It is kind of built into the way they build in the first place. Your Wall Street Journal piece, you mentioned the great shrine on Issei, 1,500 years old, beautiful, huge wooden shrine, and it is rebuilt from scratch deliberately every 20 years, Ian. This is a country that knows that cycle of building and building again.
It knows very well that nothing lasts forever.
Ian Buruma, author of Taming the Gods, Religion and Democracy on Three Continents. It's always good to speak with you. Thank you very much for being with us from New York today, Ian.
Pleasure.
And Richard Samuels of MIT, author of Securing Japan. Dick Samuels, it's been a long time since we first focused on Japan, and I'm sorry to have to look back on it when it's in the middle of this trouble, but it's a country with deep, strong roots. We wish it well. Thank you for being with us here today, Dick.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.